Welcome to the podcast of Paley Presbyterian Church. The following sermon is by our associate pastor, Becca Bruner.
So I want to invite you to picture something with me. Picture a small alpine village way up in the mountains. And I'm gonna describe it for you, but I have to give full disclosure here. I've never been to the Alps at all. So what I picture is kind of a conglomeration probably of the Sound of Music and the Matterhorn at the Disneyland. So picture it with me. You probably, if you've seen them in real life, can picture it better. But what I picture is that it is cute little chalets nestled just right in the crook of the mountain. Barns with thatched roofs, cows with jangling bells around their necks wandering around grassy meadows spotted with edelweiss. Could be true, I don't know. But picture it. And picture in this village, in the center of this village, a beautiful stream running right through. The stream comes from high up in the mountains, fed by springs that come from within the mountain. Water is crystal clear. Children play and laugh beside it. Swans and geese swim in it. Looking into the stream, the water is so clear. You can see every grain of sand. You can see rocks. You can see rainbow trout swimming at the bottom. High up in those hills, far beyond anyone's sight, lives an old man who serves as the keeper of this stream. He was hired so long ago, nobody even remembers when he wasn't there. And he would go, spend his time just traveling between the various springs that feed into this stream, and he'd spend his time removing branches or fallen leaves or debris that might pollute the water. His work was important, but it was completely unseen. Well, one year the town council decided that they had better things to do with their money than pay this unseen man. They had roads to repair, they had taxes to collect, services to offer, and giving money to this unseen, unsupervised stream cleaner, well, that had become a luxury they could no longer afford. So the old man left his post, and high up in the mountains, the springs went unattended. Twigs and branches, and worse, muddied the water. Mud and silt compacted the creek bed. Farm wastes turned parts of that stream into stagnant bogs, and for a time, anyhow, no one in the village noticed. But after a while, the water just wasn't the same. It began to look brackish. The swans flew away to live somewhere else. The stream just didn't have that clear, crisp scent that drew children to play by it. Some people in the town actually began to grow ill. The life of the village depended on the stream, and the life of the stream, well, it depended on the keeper. The city council eventually reconvened, and the money was found, and the old man was rehired. And after some time, the springs were cleaned, and the stream was pure again. Children once again played on its banks. Illness was replaced by health. The swans came home, and the village came back to life. The life of the village depended on the health of the stream. And the health of the stream depended on the keeper. It's a nice story, but it's not just a story. It's not just a story about an alpine village. It's a story about you. It's a story about me. For you see, this stream is your soul. And you and I, we are the keeper. Author and theologian Dallas Willard writes, "Our soul is like a stream of water which gives strength, direction, and harmony to every other area of our life. When that stream is as it should be, we are constantly refreshed and exuberant in all we do because our soul itself is then profusely rooted in the vastness of God and his kingdom, including nature. And all else within us is enlivened and directed by that stream. Therefore, we are in harmony with God, reality, and the rest of human nature, and nature at large." Well, as Jeff introduced last week, this fall, we are embarking on this incredibly important journey learning about the keeping of our souls. Using John Ortberg's book as a guide, we will learn together how to be soul keepers, each one of us. Because as you heard Jeff talk about last week, and you will hear if you stay after the service today, as a church, we have a vision called by God, compelled by the love of Jesus and empowered by the Holy Spirit. We end relational poverty by inviting everyone to know and experience the love of Jesus and by building authentic relationships with one another. As we live out Vision 2020, as we bring an end to relational poverty in our church and our surrounding community, we must start by recognizing the poverty within ourselves, the poverty within our souls. We are the keeper of our own souls, yet how many of us really feel confident in understanding and being able to articulate what a soul actually is? A few examples, ways we use it. From birth to our final resting place, we say, may God rest his soul. The soul is our earliest companion and our ultimate concern, but most of us are pretty unfamiliar with what it actually means. Author Jeffrey Boyd says that most church attenders, most of us, we kind of adopt a Looney Tunes theory of the soul. We've all watched those episodes of Looney Tunes, right, where perhaps Daffy Duck meets his early demise through a stick of dynamite. And that happens, and he falls over dead, and then up from his body floats a transparent image of him that would most certainly have wings and be carrying a harp. And that translucent image, as it flies up to heaven, would have choice words for Bugs Bunny, the most likely culprit who set off that dynamite, right? We think about souls this way, don't we? Because we can't see a soul. It can't be put on a microscope or viewed through an x-ray. But 100 years ago, a doctor tried to kind of quantify the soul, to understand the soul in some way. And the way he did this is he measured the slight weight loss experienced by 7 tuberculosis victims at the exact moment of their death. And from this study, he was led to believe that the soul weighs 21 grams. You will be unsurprised to know that this study has never been duplicated and is generally widely disregarded and ridiculed by the medical community. Someone even said this to me right before the service today. Our politicians, every electoral cycle, we hear politicians and pundits warn us that the soul of America is at stake. Derek Jeter was once said to be the soul of the Yankees. Quarterback Tom Brady, he deemed the receiver Wes Walker as the soul of the New England Patriots. These are, of course, our metaphors. But they point to the notion of the soul being that which holds the larger entity together, which leads me to wonder if the Phillies will ever have a soul. I don't know.
Saints.
Cubs fans, sorry. At least according to countless operas and books and country music lyrics, a soul is something that can be lost or even sold. In the TV show The Simpsons, Homer sells his soul for a donut and then impulsively eats all of it save for one last bite, which he puts in the refrigerator with the instructions, "Do not eat, soul donut." Churches, we're supposed to know about souls, right? There's a song that we often sing with a line that says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul." But it's a line we sing. It comes from the Psalms, but what does it mean? How can your soul bless or make happy the Lord? Old-time evangelists rode the circuit, traveling from town to town so that they could win just one more soul for Jesus. But when they won it, what did they win? So I ask once again, what is the soul? Well, Jesus had much to say on the subject of souls. We're going to look at one such passage today from the book of Matthew, chapter 16, starting at verse 24. We're reading today from the New International Version. Matthew tells us, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it.' What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for the soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. Truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now there's something that we miss in this passage when we read it in English. If we could all together read it in the original Greek, which I will confess I no longer can, but if we all could read it in the original Greek, we would see that there's this one word that gets repeated over and over again. It's the Greek word psuche, or psyche. It's where we get the word psychology. And we don't see it in English, how often it gets repeated, because in English the translators translate it a whole number of different ways. But in verses 25 and 26, it is all over the place. I'll show you here an example. Jesus says, whoever wants to save their psyche, we read that life, whoever wants to save their psyche will lose it, whoever loses their psyche will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their psyche? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their psyche? All the same word. It's translated so many different ways because it's just one of these words that has a richer, a deeper meaning that can't be contained with one English word. It can be translated breath, as in the breath of life. It can be translated life. It can be translated soul. But in the modern translation of the Bible, the Message, I think Eugene Peterson gets it just spot on. In this passage, in what Jesus says here, he translates psyche as your true self. Your true self. Again, reading from Dallas Willard, he says, what is running your life at any given moment is your soul. Not external circumstances, not your thoughts, not your intentions, not even feelings, but your soul. The soul is that aspect of your whole being that correlates, integrates, and enlivens everything going on in the various dimensions of the soul, or of the self. The soul is the life center of human beings. So what does that look like? Dallas Willard puts it in terms of a series of concentric circles. The innermost circle is the human will, the capacity to choose. You can say yes, or you can say no. The will is what makes you a person and not a thing. The will is central to our spiritual lives, but it's limited, it's conflicted. Just one example. Imagine you're sitting down to a steak dinner, and you have this beautiful steak in front of you. You know, you look at it and you go, you know what? The worst parts of this steak, the worst parts for me, for my health, are the parts that taste the best. And so I have these conflicting desires with me. I want to eat the parts that taste the best, but I also want to live past 50. So what's the will to do? So that's why the will meets the next part of the human being. The will meets the mind. That's the next part of the person. In the ancient world, the mind referred both to a person's thoughts and their feelings. That's all inhabited in the mind. Thoughts and feelings, they're flowing through us all the time, mostly in habitual patterns that willpower can't sustainably redirect. I mean, you don't will yourself to feel something, right? Not most of the time, right? You just feel it. Or it's not because you're not thinking something by intentional choice. It's a thought pops into your head, or it's just a habitual pattern, something that you're used to thinking about all the time. The will has some power over the mind, but not much. So the mind and the will, they have two parts of the human being, but they are housed in the body. Now our bodies are filled with all kinds of appetites and desires, and in a way, we outsource all kinds of our behaviors, from tying our shoes to driving our cars, to our bodies so that our minds and our wills, they don't have to worry about it. Our bodies are amazing. They're amazing, but they're not the whole story. I am more than just the stuff that my body is made of. So then finally, surrounding all of this, all of these circles, is the soul. Again, the words of Dallas Willard. He says, the soul is the capacity to integrate all the parts into a single whole life. It's something like a computer program, that runs a computer. You don't usually notice it until something messes up. See, according to Willard, the soul seeks harmony and connection and integration. The human soul seeks to integrate our will and our mind and our body into one integral person. The soul seeks to connect us to one another and to God himself, who made us to be rooted in him, the way a tree is rooted by a life-giving stream. In short, the soul is the deepest part of you. It is the whole person. Your soul is what integrates, what holds together your will, your intentions, your mind, your thoughts, your feelings, your values, and your conscience, and your body, your face, your body language, your actions. Your soul integrates all of those things into one single life. And a soul is healthy. A soul is working as it should be when there is harmony between those three entities and between God's will for all of creation. When you are connected with God and with other people in your life, you have a healthy soul. It is possible, however, to have an unhealthy soul. Jesus said it's possible that one might even lose their soul. What good would it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul, Jesus said. Well, there are many who have believed along the way, perhaps even some of us, they've believed this verse to mean, well, really, you shouldn't try to make a lot of money, you shouldn't have a lot of sex, you shouldn't engage in all kinds of earthly pleasures if in the long run you're just going to end up going to hell. Right? To forfeit your soul means you're ending up in hell. But that's not what this verse means. A forfeited soul isn't about a destination, but rather a diagnosis. A person whose will and mind and body are disintegrated, disconnected from God, and living at odds with the way God made the universe to run. To lose my soul means I no longer have a healthy center that organizes and guides my life. I'm a car without a steering wheel. It doesn't matter how fast I can go. Eventually, I am a crash waiting to happen. So how does this happen? How does this disintegration, this disconnection happen? How does one lose or forfeit their soul? Well, it starts small. It starts, I believe, when we stop thinking of ourselves as souls and replace that soul with a self. A soul and a self, they're very different entities. Historically, there have been two schools of thought when it comes to the self. There's the traditional Eastern worldview of the self, and then there's the modern or Western worldview. The traditional Eastern view says that the goal of human existence is actually to lose yourself. To lose yourself. In this view, if a person were to ask, you know, go to a mentor or a family member or something and ask, who am I? Who am I supposed to become? The answer would be, well, what in the world do you mean? Who are you? That's a silly question. You're your family. You're your community. You're your country. You are your duty to your family, your community, your country. You have a role to fill, so fill it. On the other hand, the modern Western worldview says the exact opposite. In modern Western cultures, when a person asks, who am I? The response is, exactly! That is what you were put on this earth to discover. All of life is about finding out who you are, who you really are, what you love, what you're good at, what gives you personally, individually, a sense of happiness and fulfillment, and then doing just that. And most of us, you know, we fall into that modern Western worldview. Just look at our language. If you're empty, fill yourself. If you're stressed, learn how to take care of yourself. When you're in a job interview, believe in yourself. If someone dares to criticize you, you have to stand up for yourself. If you're going on a date, well, you have to be yourself. But what if yourself? Kind of a train wreck. What do you do then? Picture the once wildly successful pastor now beyond the age where most people retire. His church is now shrinking, his influence waning, and his mood miserable. He'll complain to anybody within earshot how wrong his critics are and how it's everyone else's fault for not bringing enough visitors to fill the pews and how everything would go back to the way it used to be if people would just listen to him. Or the mom who struggles to create the perfect home. Her husband doesn't help much, and she doesn't tell him how much she resents it, mostly because she's afraid of conflict. She's angry with her children for not being perfect, for not being on track to get into the right school, for not making her look good as a mom. She's angry at her body for aging. I mean, feeling attractive has been the one unforced sense of worth in her life, and it is ebbing away. She drinks a little too much. She gossips with her friends about her friends. She withdraws. Or the businessman, who's devoted his life to making money. His children always knew that they had less priority in his life than his job. He never said so, of course, but our deepest devotions have a way of leaking out of our bodies by how we spend our time, what makes us smile, what claims our energy. The man built a corporate empire, but his employees all felt used. He was able to build a magnificent home overlooking the ocean, but now sits in that house all alone, as he recently had a stroke and no one comes to visit him. He thinks the problem is his parishioners. She thinks the problem is with her husband or her kids or her age. He thinks the problem is with all those ungrateful employees. But it's not. It's his soul, her soul, my soul, your soul. Truth is, the more we focus on ourselves, the more we neglect our souls. You see, the self is a standalone unit, while the soul reminds us that we weren't made for ourselves. The soul always exists before God. We lose our soul when we focus too much on ourselves. So how do we find it? Well, Jesus told us directly. He said, whoever wants to be my disciple, whoever wants to find their soul, must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. Deny yourself. Deny that you can do this life by yourself. Deny that you have within you the capacity to save yourself. There is a Savior, and it is not you. And it is not me. Jesus came to save you, and Jesus came to save me because we desperately needed it. So deny yourself. Allow Jesus to be the Savior that he is. Deny yourself and take up your cross. Now, this phrase, taking up one's cross, it's been used a lot of ways that I don't think it really means. It doesn't mean endure unchosen suffering with a smile. Abuse, disease, disasters, and death happen to us not because God wills them, but because there is sin and it has a heavy and powerful effect on this world. We're not called to simply sit back and take it, but we are called to take up our cross. And the cross that Jesus calls up to take is not one of unchosen suffering, but chosen. To take up our cross is to recognize that the goal in this life is not me, myself, my comfort. It's to recognize that my calling is to enter in to somebody else's struggle, somebody else's pain and trauma and despair, and to make them my own. It's making my life a little bit more painful, to spend less money on myself, to step out of my comfort zone of security and ease, to allow myself to be inconvenienced. It's making my life a little bit more painful so that somebody else's life might be a lot less painful. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Follow Jesus. Jesus, who everything he asks of us, he has done for us. Because of course, Jesus denied himself. That night that he knew he was going to die, Jesus wept in a garden, praying desperately, Father, take this cup from me. I don't want to do this. But confessing that he was not in charge, it wasn't about himself, Jesus prayed, not my will, but yours be done. Jesus denied himself, and he took up his cross. Jesus took the path of chosen suffering. Jesus entered into our world. He took on our pain, our trauma, our despair, and he made them his own. So whoever wants to be my disciple, must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save their soul will lose it. But whoever loses their soul for me will find it. Friends, finding your soul isn't just about where you go when you die. It's about healing and deliverance today at the deepest level of who we are in the care of God through the presence of Jesus. For your soul is like a stream of water which gives strength, direction, and harmony to every other area of your life. Your soul is a stream, and you are the keeper. And the keeping of these souls, it begins not with us, but with the one who gifted us with these souls in the first place.